to all that slack and Gigye. I any of you actual true sub genii out there who know something about slack know that the power of slack is instant reversibility, and you can at any moment turn something into a winning situation. You don't actually have to be chained by like your past reaction to something. And Keith, like, geez, like, if you want to fight Bob, like, I ask yourself, like, what good having a subgenius membership card will do you. Like, I suspect it's zero, and you're smart enough to realize that, and, you know, it might be less than zero. So I'd say, like, you know, think on that.
Well, if you, I'll say this for Keith, that what he posts, if one can read way below into the quantum levels, he's smiling as he does all this, quote, violence, and he is working for me, and it's great satire that he's doing. With there, I give him that potential. That maybe he's not always that cognizant, and so he knows that his personality will provide material, and he may occasionally forget who he's aiming at. But there's an irony.
He's got enough slack to turn to, you know, reinvent his own, to reinvent everything in the present to his own favor if he has to.
Yeah, he's got the alibis all there backing him up. Now, did you find the Techno Boredom page in the Book of the Subgenius?
Oh, I wasn't looking. I could go find it now if you want, but actually I'd rather talk about something else.
Okay, go ahead.
Which is what I responded to Freighter 222 today.
Yeah.
Because he put up a post that was two quotes for the paramodern age.
Yes, I read that.
Yeah. So you have Baudrillard saying, "We no longer partake of the drama of alienation. We are in the ecstasy of communication."
Yep.
And then the next quote was his own, I believe it was himself.
Yes.
Swerving that quote to say, instead of the ecstasy of communication, that we're in the awkwardness of communication.
Yeah.
And I commented about how, like, yes, absolutely, ecstasy is awkward and definitely the main virus threatening to choke slack where it lives is the illusion that you can both have your ecstasy and be confident in being cool or seeming cool or, like, having everything together and not being awkward at the same time. But much more important is this use of the word awkward because, okay, here's another whole coincidental deal, which is not necessarily xenochronous because it wasn't exactly a media thing.
Yeah.
So much as like a I don't know, some kind of just like psychic flash. I've been to New York City twice. The second time was when I came and met you and interviewed you, and I'm not sure where, I thought that full interview was on the net somewhere, but I really don't know where. There's only a fragment of it that's on the Torpor Vigil Industries website that pertains to you talking about the lyrics to Sam Andreas' songs. But
and that was that was late November, early December 2002, about a month after I was finished, 3 weeks,
yeah.
4 weeks after being on Cloak and Dagger, right.
Yeah, it was tied into the... No, it was right after. It was tied into the Cloak and Dagger thing because me being in transit on my way down there made me miss the 18th show where you were just silent. So you had to tell me what happened. I hadn't read it. I hadn't heard it.
There's your 18 bias coming in. It was 17th show.
Oh, really?
Unless I'm wrong, but I may have miscalculated, but I've always said...
17... I thought you put in the content for 17 and that you decided, like, because 17 is, like, 17 chapters spinning his wake or something, that should be enough so that for the 18th you were just going to be silent.
That's a good point, but I thought I did it in the 17th show, so we need to check that. But either way, 17 or 18.
Either way.
Go ahead.
That's beside the point. That was the second time I went to New York. The first time I went to New York was fall 2002 was the second time. The first time I went there was in the spring of 2001, in March of 2001, which later on, like this might be relevant to what happened to me while I was there, but it turned out that I was in New York. I like arrived there within days, I think, or right at the same time that Paul Laffoley had his accident there, where he was setting up his gallery show and fell and broke his leg.
And you know so that I was part of that.
I hope you weren't part of him losing his leg, but you were part of something there.
Yes. Okay. I will let you tell your story, then I'll fill in mine.
Okay. Yeah. So the thing, I mean, I didn't know anything about Paul Laffoley at the time. I hadn't been introduced to his work, although he's since become like far, far, far and away my favorite, just visual artist that way.
Yeah.
Like a painter, for lack of a better word, doesn't quite apply to his genre. But I was unaware of him. That's just a post facto thing. What I was really impressed by was that I went to New York, and most of the time that I was there, I had these very vivid and mostly very horrible dreams. Like, I knew something weird was going on, because especially the first dream, the first night I got there, I don't necessarily want to, it's not the most relevant one, but just these really disturbing nightmares while I was in New York City. I was like, there is something about this city that is really getting to my brain, because I was just having these nightmares.
How long were you there?
10 days, I think, or maybe just a week.
Were you in Sam's...
I should really remember exactly.
Yeah, were you in Sam's apartment there?
His sister's apartment.
Yeah, you were coming with Sam?
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So I had these crazy dreams, but then the climactic dream, which was probably the fifth or sixth night that I was there, after I'd already had three that had these distinctly disturbing elements... I had this other dream, which still stands as the weirdest dream I've ever had, but it very strongly relates to you, and remembering this dream really tripped me out when I was first discovering your writings and getting into this whole thing. So I want to relate the story of this dream.
Okay.
It's very weird. This would be like a good point to say, like, hey, Alt Up Slack, if you're not interested in any of this, fast forward to this time, because I want you to hear about this weird-ass dream I had in March 2001. It relates to Freighter 222 as well. So,
right, and you have not... You know McLuhan, and you know Church of Genius at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, Subgenius on the brain plays a big part of this dream.
Okay.
So, here's the dream. The dream was like a really...
Are you there? Okay, it's September 15th. We're back with Ad Absurdum. It's 24 hours later because right after Ad Absurdum said, here goes my dream, his phone went dead. So we've been hanging here, bated breath, for 24 hours, and now we're going to hear about the dream, maybe a little preamble before he goes into the dream because of events that are not going to be piled on over the last 24 hours. And but this is technically... the third hour, as you'll hear it on the site, but it is the next day, September 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Ad Absurdum.
Hello. So, the preamble is necessary because it's the explanation of, I guess, why I had to get cut off and it had to be done the next night, because it totally has this nice little self-referential. It's almost like in the animated Alice in Wonderland, there's a little creature that... paints a path, and then there's another creature that comes along and sweeps it up behind him, and that gets Alice lost. Sometimes these anachronies kind of like, it doesn't exactly add meaning, it just tips its own hat to I'm definitely here. I mentioned on the internet that Freighter 222 on Five Bodied had said something. He had swerved, to use Harold Bloom's phrase, he had swerved a Baudrillard quote to replace the ecstasy of communication with the awkwardness of communication. And I said to him, well, that might be the explanation I've been looking for why it was the word awkward that showed up in this weird, weird X-Files dream that I had the first time I went to New York. And so then today, I really like the X-Files, but I never saw how the thing ended. I never saw any of it after it didn't have the original actors. I used to be really into it and following it in like 96, 97, 98, well, more 97. But I didn't see. So I've been watching them on DVD a little bit, and you can sometimes buy, you can buy the box sets of the DVDs. So I've been slowly over the years, I've been getting them used in order. And for a long time, we've been looking around for season 7, which I've never seen. I'd seen some of season 6 originally, but looking around, season 7 of the X-Files, no one has it. We never find it. Season 7 of the X-Files. So then last night I get cut off. Today, just before Bob called me in the afternoon, shortly before, we found season 7 of the X-Files at a very reasonable factor, very reasonable price. And then later on, Bob calls me. While I'm talking to Bob, someone walks by me wearing a Bob Marley T-shirt with the name Bob is like a full third of the image right across the top of it, which is unusual for these Bob Marley T-shirts. And so that was funny, right while I'm on the phone, and it ties into a whole other thing we were just talking about before we started recording. But the thing is that it's season 7, it has 22 episodes, and one of the weirdest, most bitchin' threads on Five-Bodied is called 722 Interference Factor. So this little 722 coincidence just had to interfere into the conversation before I actually got around to telling the X-Files dream. But I was just informed right now, right before we began, I was just informed that there's a band that has a song called Ad Absurdum, and the band is called Arcturus. Now, I may have seen that before, but I didn't remember it anyway. It felt new, the information, that I thought there was a band called Ad Absurdum, which there might also be. But so Arcturus plays Ad Absurdum, and I don't know my astronomy well enough. I was just informed that Arcturus is one of the stars in the Booties, and that in the where the Bootians that Bob talks about often are coming from, and that it's 7 stars. So the 722 interference factor, it's possible that that little just self-referring to its own only being an interference factor and not pretending to be a content comment on what we were saying, but only an interference factor coincidence, maybe was even caused by a little interfering Bobion particle coming from the Booties, because it's 7 of them interfering with the 22 of Bob.
Right, and in August 2004, when they created the Marsh McLuhan Street, you know, right in front of St. Mike's Library. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were that. Were you there that day? Well, anyways, we taped it.
Showed up a little late, but yeah.
And well, we went up to McLuhan's office, which was no longer McLuhan's office, but his building, and might have been to Kirchhoff's office. But Von Echo and us were looking, and there was a map, a star map or something. Mm-hmm. And the Bootian's constellation was exactly at the intersection of 22 and 14, I think it was.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, right in McLuhan's center. And so when you mention this 22, I think of that. I'll have to go back and get the precision, but it was incredible. It was 22 and probably 14, which is the what Dobbstown fights against. 22, the baby boomers, and 14, the Generation X, right? So, and you're neither of those. You're the next level. What do you consider? Are you considered late Generation X?
No, I'm kind of... I guess I'm included in Generation Y, although I think that the people who consider themselves Generation Y are generally getting into their 30s, and I think that I'm more on the fringes of whatever the new breed is.
Well, that's Morpheus. That's the Morpheus generation, according to my up the orphic auntie. You're a little early. You're born in the early 80s, right?
Yeah, 81. My friend Nigel came up with the designation of the glitch generation.
Okay.
Glitch, and particularly 1981 being the year of the glitch.
Yeah.
I could explain, but not quickly enough at all.
Okay, but that's appropriate, because you're just in the interval before the Morpheus generation, which gets born around the time the Berlin Wall goes down, and they are born into a new consciousness. And that,
mm-hmm.
that's my audience, the Morpheus generation, but maybe you could be the St. Augustine for them. If you seem to be already leaning that way with your advanced articulations. Okay.
Well,
so
I won't settle for any less than Augustine and Luther and Joseph Smith. And maybe something else, too, to make it nice and tetradic.
Yeah, maybe Aleister Crowley?
Yeah, maybe. He flips it.
Okay, so, all right, so you've done the preamble. Is a little more preamble for before we hear about the dream? Or is
Nope, I could jump right into the dream because it's an X-Files dream. That's what makes it so bizarro. Okay, and it was, I had had dreams like this or that used this kind of formal device before, but I'd never had a dream like this. I just stopped myself from saying it was this dream cut back and forth between whole genres of ways of dreaming where I had started to develop this occasional type of dreaming where I wasn't there. It was basically like a movie or movie-ish experience that I was experiencing. I was just being shown things. Or sometimes it could even be that people would react to me as if I was there, but it was still just like a movie they were more reacting to any viewer. But that was just trying to lay the ground of this type of dreaming where it's not things you're doing in places you are, it's just being shown things.
Isn't that kind of like lucid dreaming, but you're not in the classical lucid state of watching or being aware you're dreaming? But you're kind of in the glitch. You're in the gap there, on the way to lucid dreaming, but still still involved in the dream. But you're watching the dream as a movie, something like that.
Something I could agree with that it would be on the way to lucid dreaming, only because it actually seemed more like the opposite of lucid dreaming. Whereas lucid dreaming would be being really fully present where you are in the dream. This was not only did I not have any control over what I'm dreaming, I am not even there, and I'm totally defaced or something, and it's just a download of a screenal experience. I would think it would be lucid if I was having a lucid dream that wasn't me walking around and participating in a lucid dream, but was just showing myself whatever kind of microfilm of possible Akashic records of filmic content that I wanted.
Right, and that's right. In lucid dreaming, you can control your dream. You can work on it, right? You weren't doing that.
No, not at all, because it was very much like a prepared film segment. And in this, whereas other dreams I'd had, I would describe it that way, like, oh, it was like some movie I was watching. This time, that became explicit because the dream began as an X-Files movie of some sort. The first fragment of the dream was in that mode.
But this is in, you're in New York and being, the weird dreams
are happening. I'll give a little introduction there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I arrived in New York, March 2001, and had the first few nights that I was there, I had dreams that had some kind of either intensely or just unsettlingly horrible content. And I was wondering what it was about New York. It was clearly something about where I was that was suddenly giving me this barrage of dreams. And then, so on the fifth or sixth night that I was there, I had this dream that I'm just beginning to relate. Now, it opens very much like an opening shot. It opens as an X-Files movie. I understand it's not an episode of the TV show. Like the camera is zooming in tensely on Scully. Do you know enough of what I'm talking about, Scully and Mulder with the X-Files on?
Yes, I never saw any of the shows, but I saw the movie.
Okay. So, Scully, the camera is zooming in on her tensely from behind as if they're conveying that the camera is the point of view of someone sneaking up on her or some threat that's approaching. And as it gets close to her, she turns and looks at the camera and gasps in terror. And then there's some kind of a flash cut to now I'm there and it's real life and it's a kind of a real life semi-participatory X-Files movie / seminar. And Scott,
are you being snuck up on?
No. It was just an opening shot of this kind of just being shown a movie. I was just experiencing, and I wasn't there. It was like my dream was entirely the movie with no audience, but only this one shot of this, as if something is threatening is approaching her from behind. She turns and gasps, afraid, or alarmed anyway. And
but
then there's a flash cut to a whole new mode.
Yeah, it's not you replace her and you're being frightened. It's something different.
No, no.
Okay.
Now it's still continuity of the story, because now she's on the ground, dazed, like as if she just briefly lost consciousness, and it's continuity of from the last shot, except that the mode changed, where now me and a few, not even a lot, like a dozen at most, other people are standing around her, and so she's getting up as if recovering from whatever has shocked her, and she starts, and she says, "Awkward? Awkward?" And even though it's totally strange, I understand perfectly well that she's calling for Mulder, and I had no explanation for why she was saying the word awkward. And anyway, then she...
And you're standing there watching her. You're like in a crowd watching her, a person getting up in a park or something. That's what you mean.
Yeah.
You're standing with a crowd of people in the movie, but watching.
Yes, although it seemed to be on some kind of... in the, like, vestibule of a warehouse where a film set would be. Like me and the people who were watching, we had come here to participate in this.
You're extras. You're extras watching a scene being taped.
Yeah, I guess you're totally right.
Yeah. The extras sit on the edge of the scene and watch until they're called in, you know, so they're in and not in, and yet they're there, right close. It's like
That's
being an extra.
I never really thought of it that way. But it makes perfect sense, but it just seemed more like a participatory... I was an extra. That's strange that I was never able to think of it so simply that way.
Have you ever been an extra?
I never have. But
yeah.
I didn't know what was going to be happening.
Well, we got a little Zanocrity. I did a few extra things over the last few years in New York. People invited me on, and it was interesting, the whole extra subculture. So that immediately comes to me, what you're describing, because I live that. But go ahead. You were saying?
Okay. She had just been calling out, awkward, awkward, and understood she was calling for Mulder. And then she immediately snaps into a more, getting things done, business-like mode, and starts giving fast orders to the people standing around her. But none that was, I don't remember one that was delivered to me. And it was a little odd. Like, she was saying things like, okay, you, go to this place and tell this person what happened this way. You, do this, get me this. And she said to one person, you, take a cab to such and such a place, I don't remember where, then pay for the cab. As if that was an extra instruction that needed to be told. So this is where the difference more comes in between thinking of it as being an extra, because it was more like we were the audience of a live-action participatory version, like as if we, I don't know, like we're on this very exclusive audience list for it or something, taking part in it this time. And
aren't you saying that you're now experiencing what the extra was to do? You stand there watching it, you're on the edge, then you come in, it jumps to what you do as an extra. You're a person she gives orders to.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. The only difference would be that how things turn out would clearly depend on how well people did. Like, the point is, she seemed to be taking it very seriously. Like, it didn't feel like we were filming somehow. It felt more like this was a real thing that had to get done.
Yeah, it's like the movie set had a problem. The director died, and suddenly her real self says to you extras, "Hey, go do this and do that to solve this problem that's interrupted our filming." It's almost like that.
Yeah, something like that. So then motion starts happening. It was a bit unclear, the transition to the next part. But the next part that I remember was, perhaps it was like a flashback to what had happened just before it, but me, the same group of people, and I were in a room with the director, and it was like the director of the movie was giving us a kind of an intro to the movie, and he was explaining things about, he was talking as if relating what had been sent to him by the producers. That he's like, well, they wanted a little, they wanted some aliens, and they wanted explosions, and they wanted a bit of this, and they wanted a bit of that. And while he was talking, my experience of the dream was fading in and out with little kind of prepared preview edited segments of the examples of the movie, of the things that he's saying as he's saying them, the things that he put into the movie because that was what was wanted. And
that's exactly what happens to extras. They are told what's going to happen and what's going on in the movie. You know, they're told, this is what we've done so far, and this is what we're doing. They've just been hired for a day, and this is what you have to be and what we're going to film next. I mean, that's totally an extras form of instruction from a director.
Mm-hmm. Although this would be a kind of so basically I was having exactly that experience, but amplified in the sense that as if he could explain it to us and telepathically instigate the exact visions in our heads of what he was talking about, because it wasn't as if there was no screen beside him on which these edited segments were occurring, and he was not part of the kind of previews you would see where they cut back and forth between the director and the things that are going on. It was as if, like, there was a full confidence that everyone else who was standing around was seeing the same examples he was talking about. It wasn't some private interpretation of what he was saying or memory. It was what we were meant to have as embellishing what he was saying.
So it's ESP. It's kind of an ESP.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of like a vision of a really enhanced communication that could even be like technologically enhanced, because these interior visions were very much the samples of the film, as if they were being beamed right into our head. There was some control set on the fading in and out between the reality of standing around with the director and the experience of seeing the edits while hearing his voice talk about them.
This is totally, to me, is totally what goes on in Five Body for the participants who get Bob Zanarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
me too.
Okay.
Whenever I review this dream over the years, it seems unbelievably prophetic in the general sense of all this stuff, and it gets more so.
Okay.
So then, almost as if the descriptions of the director had been lulling us into just kind of getting used to being on the track of being told about it, the next part seemed like a bit of a surprise. In the live-action world where I really am standing with the director, he concludes what he's saying, where they want a bit of this, a bit of that, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so let me ask you, is David Bowie familiar as he gestures towards this larger space beside where we were, where huddled underneath some kind of a blanket or sheet in the middle of the floor, is suddenly reveals himself to be David Bowie, dressed up as some weird character halfway between Ziggy Stardust and the Man Who Fell to Earth. And then without saying anything, David Bowie immediately rises up in the air as if he's levitating or flying towards a big green egg-shaped, intricately, kind of looking like a big Fabergé egg set piece that's like twice as tall as David Bowie is, but that's up in the corner of the ceiling. And he starts rising towards this, and where some, we understand, like where some impressive transformation is supposed to occur as he ascends to this green egg. And it's clear to us that that this is kind of part of the movie or something that the director is indicating to us. And but strangely, something is going wrong when David Bowie gets up there. Like something has gotten stuck, and now you can see that he's on these wires, and that something has gotten caught on part of the egg, and that David Bowie was then trying to jimmy it with a shovel to try to get it free and make it work again. But there was something very distinctly intentional about all this, like the wires were just a little bit too visible, and the readiness of this shovel and the way he's trying to jimmy it was like, it was this very bizarre self-deprecating comedy thing of, like, that's almost one of the main flavors of comedy these days, or certain animated stuff especially, is that whatever someone intends to mean or whatever is supposed to happen gets, like, thwarted some way, and then there's this weird self-deprecation of low-budgetness and cheapness towards effects.
But you're saying that this may have been planned.
It wasn't definite, but just the whole scene smelled too much like it was being self-consciously done that way and not a real mess up, and David Bowie really just trying to fix it as quickly as he can. Like, yeah, that it smelled planned.
Yeah.
And so then this thing that's going on then fades into by the way, the director was Jonathan Landis. I forgot to say that. Which, to me, I associate him. I know he directed all sorts of things, Animal House, An American Werewolf in London, but to me, I associate with him with having directed Michael Jackson's Thriller video.
Okay.
Which is really cool. And the making of Michael Jackson's Thriller, he geeks out. It's very much, the dream was influenced a lot by that because it's a documentary of him and Michael Jackson, but particularly Jonathan Landis talking as if Michael Jackson is the producer, saying like, well, he wanted there to be werewolves and zombies, and we came up with this, you know, and here's the cool makeup we used. Anyway, so then the thing with David Bowie doing rising up to the egg then fades back into the I'm just being shown something and just experiencing some vision and sound, and it's not, and I'm not there.
Right.
I guess I'm not there, all that really means is that you cut off the smell, taste, and feeling and gravity sense, and it just brings it down to the eye and the ear. Okay, so I fade back into that, but it wasn't like a prepared film whereas the earlier segments I knew I was watching an X-Files movie, and then it was kind of being telepathically beamed into my head of what he wanted to say. This faded more into just my own dream world of having that effect.
What effect?
But it's the effect of me not being there and the dream just being, I'm being shown some kind of vision and sound. I'm just experiencing things without me being present where I am, where what's being experienced is going on.
Right.
Or even that it's like a prepared film segment being beamed directly onto an interior screen in my mind.
It's not even that, or it is beamed. It does seem to be beamed. Are you saying it is that, or it
seems like it must be beamed because it's only an interior mind screen thing, and not, I'm dreaming that I am somewhere.
Right. Gotcha.
What I'm saying is I didn't know this to be, like, I could attribute the first one to the X-Files movie and the second one to what Jonathan Landis meant, but this was just kind of having a dream. What it faded into, but it was still filming because it was a slow pan to the right, I remember for some reason, over a very low definition cartoon drawn, like comic book drawn landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Very just gray and flat, as if it had been drawn with just a pencil and done really simply. But it still was very evocative, and it felt like some kind of moon or alien or desert landscape with certain angular distant mountain kind of things. But it was panning, and yet I remember there being as well, as well as this very low-definition alien landscape, there was, I guess, in the sky, but basically filling up most of the visual field, was what I could only describe as a face that was very close to being the Dobbs head, but not quite the Dobbs head.
Okay.
A face that, there's no way that it was accidentally like that. It was clearly a swerve of the Dobbs head. Like, its essence and meaning was that it was not quite the Dobbs head. And I heard a voice say, as if this is the voiceover on the beginning of some weird documentary, the voice says, "Who is?" Equally slight variation on the name J.R. Bob Dobbs.
Perfect, perfect.
And then I woke up.
Wow. And that's March 2001.
Yeah.
That is when Bob Marshall comes to New York City to live.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He
helped me move my library down, which had been in storage for since the early 90s, since we left Toronto in 93. Thanksgiving, American Thanksgiving, November 2000, he and a Mario guy who is in the film. Yeah, Mario is a guy who is in the film business. He'd be in that position of looking. He's a filmer or, you know, cameraman or a grip or a guy who helps on the set. So Mario and Ed, Bob Marshall and I drove down that weekend, and we got there on Thanksgiving and moved all the books in. Then he liked it, so then he went back to Toronto, and then he determined to go live in the United States, and he didn't have a green card, so he had to sort of go in as a tourist and hang out for 6 months and then go back, you know, and then come back in again. So he came in March, April 2001, and he stayed with us for a while until we got him another place to live. But I'm relating, okay, time-wise, that's what's going on in my life. Personally, with the Toronto scene, is Bob Marshall shows up. Okay, so what else is going on then? We're still in the idyllic pre-911 world, you know? Everything's going great, supposedly.
Yeah, except that when I look at the other dreams that I had, two of them seem, the other horrible ones, two of them seem pretty, I don't know, they really ring to me as if I was experiencing some kind of pre-echo of the specific bad vibe that was going to be descending on that city 6 months later.
Yeah, and people are just settling in with the fact that Bush won the election, or Bush was selected, you know. That's March 2001, you know. There's the whole confusion in December, then January's inaugurated, all these protests against him that wasn't supposedly televised, and then February, March, people are, spring's coming, but oh, we're in a new zone now with a weird kind of president, so... So, yes, there could be, that's the beginning of the dark period for America, so to speak. It's starting to be foreshadowed, and maybe New York is your way of thinking of America, but you definitely were picking up on something horrible coming.
Well, yeah, I mean, specifically there was a dream that I put up that I described on Five Body not too long ago in relation to the issue of Kigge threatening to commit suicide.
Yeah.
It was that I one of these dreams, part of it, I was on a bus, and I knew I was in New York City. It was a New York City bus. I was on a bus pulling away from the curb, and just as we're pulling away from the curb, I notice that there's someone standing on the sidewalk with a gun, and they walk out into the street so that they're right behind the bus, and I'm at the back window, and I'm looking out at them. And just as the bus is pulling away, they put this gun to their own head. They're looking right at me, and looking at me with this look in the eye that clearly communicates that if he was to suddenly blow his head off right at that moment, it would be meant as an attack on my... It would be meant as a... you know, something to traumatize me.
Yeah.
so that he was offing himself.
Yeah, this is
so
for you.
When I think about that in retrospect, it seems very much like, okay, yes, like suicide to traumatize me sounds like 6 months later.
And what was the last phrase? 6 months later?
Is that what sounds like September 11th.
Yes, yeah. And that's a good point, but that dream happened just a couple of years ago.
That was like the last dream I had before the X-Files dream. That was one of the horrible dreams I had when I was in New York City in March 2000. Like, I woke up from that feeling real, you know, that wasn't a nice feeling to oh yeah, because the dream ended with he like, right after this feeling had been communicated clearly, he took the gun away from his head and pointed it at me right before I woke up.
Wow,
it wasn't a nice dream. It was very unsettling. Like, I wasn't terrified, but I was like, what is going on with my dreams? So that was like the third unsettling one I'd had.
Right, and I say 2 months ago, 2 years ago, it was 2 years ago that you reported this on Five Body because Kigi threatened to kill himself, reminded you of the dream.
Hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, back to the amazing dream, there's lots of intimations of your interaction with me in that. That's incredible.
Oh, yeah. Because of that dream, this whole thing, I can actually describe it as a dream come true, bumping into you.
Yes, because the director imparting ideas in your head or images of what he was doing without any props, that's what goes on in Five Body. I say a few words, and then people hallucinate on it, and then they see it in bus stops and T-shirts and report back all the images imparted, but I didn't do any technology. I didn't make a film of it. I didn't do anything. I maybe wrote a few words. And it goes directly into the five-bodied cult member victims, and they start reacting to what they think happened and report back, and that's what you're saying. Landis would impart the instructions to the extras or to the people listening about what's going to happen. Then a rock star, not Zappa, but a rock star goes up, and the effects precede the causes kind of feeling, which is one of the main five-body percepts to get. He's setting up a thing that's going to cause a problem. It's another version of 911. Uh-oh, we got a problem here. We better fix it. But it's all faked for other reasons. Which is what a lot of people would accuse me of doing, faking all kinds of things for other reasons than the apparent. So it seems that the effects preceding the causes is one part of this dream. You know, that
I took a lot of meaning from the image of David Bowie as being someone like he made himself into. He's a little bit more of a weird symbol than most rock stars, and significantly, he was in the David Lynch movie. He was in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me in the nightmare sequence that includes weird television effects.
Exactly. I was thinking of that and holding myself back and interjecting that that's exactly the David Bowie we're thinking of when you talk about that dream. You know, that's the scene.
Sometimes the coincidence web works through people having similar initials. Like, there's a whole M.M. coincidence web, for example. But I've found that there are far more resonant figures out there that have the initials DB rather than BD.
Yeah, I had not thought of David Bowie.
And so he's one of these anti-Dobbs, like false Dobbs.
Yes, and he's a big influence on Dale Cooper in Twin Peaks, because he'd been through it. he'd been through what Dale Cooper's going to go through.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been to the back Black Lodge and all that. It would be interesting to go back and look and see what time the computer screen has and all those little details on that scene. I never remember, is it Philadelphia or Pittsburgh that Dale Cooper is back in the office of the FBI and when David Bowie comes in,
It's funny because that's never what I remember. What I always remember is what he says. He says, Gordon, it's 10:10 a.m. on February 16th, and February 16th is 2/16, which... Not on the recording, but I was talking with Bob at length yesterday about, or the day before, about two scenes lately going through the roof and all that.
Yeah, and so you and Kenzie have discussed the 2/16 of that scene before. You're not just wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And February, it's 10:10, which is 11, and then you got February 16th is That's what I like, the fact that he's pointing out the numerical thing. They're down to the, it's 10-10, not 11-05, Dale.
Yeah.
It's 10-10, it's February 16th. Didn't we discuss this 2 weeks ago? You know, it's something like that, right?
Yeah.
Which is total Xenocrity talk by Lynch, you know what I mean? He's showing how people who talk about synchronicity, he's doing it. He's acting it out, how people do that, right?
Yep, and, yeah. And a tiny side note, I'll try to keep it tiny, there's a writer who did a fairly long journalist piece. I read it in his collected, like, essay, or collected nonfiction, but it was probably published in something like Vanity Fair or something, a kind of a, like, you know, a 9-page feature article on David Lynch, a writer by the name of David Foster Wallace, and I've read a bunch of his fiction, too, and it's really good, and apparently yesterday he was found dead as an apparent suicide. He was only 40-something, and has a really, like, his writing is known for being extremely comic, so I find it very, you know, when you hear Hunter S. Thompson shot himself in the head, it doesn't really, like, create that much cognitive dissonance, but it's kind of really shocking to me to hear that David Foster Wallace apparently killed himself, and he did a long journalist piece on Lynch, and hung out with him while he was shooting, I think, Mulholland Drive, and it was from him that I learned that David Lynch is the sort of guy that, one of the things he said, this is the kind of guy who will say, gee golly, or something, and not be ironic about it.
Yeah, I saw David Wallace in New York do a book reading. I don't remember interacting with him much, but yeah, I'm aware. What's his book called? A Jest or something? The Big
Infinite
Mass?
Jest.
What is it?
Infinite Jest.
Sounds like Slobbering Anus or something.
Really? Well,
no, I'm just joking.
I really enjoyed that book, so I wouldn't. I wouldn't take it as anything but a good sign. But it's interesting.
I take it as anything as what? You wouldn't take it as anything as a
anything but a good sign if you would say that it sounds like Slobbering Anus in any weird way. But there was something there was a letter. I only heard about it by there was a letter written into the Toronto Star today that mentioned seeing it on their online edition because it didn't hit yesterday morning papers, and they referenced it. But they referenced that book, Infinite Jest. They wanted to remind people that at the center of that book is a video that is so funny that people can't stop watching it or can't even think in the face of it, so it basically kills them or turns them into, like, it vacates their mind. It, like, vacuums out their ability to maintain their identity in the face of it.
That's the content in Infinite Jest. That's a detail of the description in the story of Infinite Jest. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's this video in the narrative of the book that's being used as a terrorist weapon. That this the father of the main character was a director, and the sister-in-law of the main character was the prettiest girl of all time, and the director figured out some weird optical way of filming her. I found it very strange because the letter writer made it sound as if the video was supposed to be so funny that it killed these people or rendered them useless. But it wasn't that at all. It was that it was like the ultimate enhancement of the prettiest girl of all time is officially how her character is referred to. That just watching it was somehow the ultimate transfixing media image to see, and it was that rendered people helpless, not that it was funny. The idea of this joke that's so funny it kills you is a subgenius idea. So I found it very perfect synchrony, this letter that was written, because it was the only thing I heard about his death, which I find disappointing. He was a real prophet. He nailed something. It's really rare to nail it this way. One of his short stories was about a contestant on Jeopardy who is so awesome that the network decides to throw out the rules where you have to kick out the contestant after 5 wins and just let them go until they're dethroned. And then that happened exactly on Jeopardy. That actually happened with this guy, some Mormon guy, I think, who who rained on there for months. But now that I think of it, I'm sure it's not so much a prophecy as someone there read that story and said, you know what, we should let this happen.
Yes.
It'll get a lot of publicity for our show. It'll make good TV. Oh, wow, Jeopardy is interesting for some reason, everybody. Look.
The Infinite Jest, the idea was this video that kills people through laughter. If this writer is a Canadian writer, he could have been influenced by Monty Python's joke that killed people. It was so funny. It killed people.
That was in the first episode, too.
Yeah, and I think the Canadians saw more of Monty Python at first because it was British TV, and the Americans got it a year or two later. So it might be something that stuck in this writer.
He is from, I think, Indiana or something like that.
The letter writer?
He definitely wasn't Canadian. Oh, David Foster Wallace.
Yeah, but the letter writer might have been a Canadian because it's a...
Oh, yeah.
And he might have mistook
it wrong.
He got it wrong, but it's a user as the content. A Canadian would think of Monty Python, and those are archetypal things in the Canadian psyche because it was such a big hit. And so he projected Monty Python into this other American story, you know. And so he got it wrong.
Totally right. I think you're totally right, especially because the musical Spamalot is playing down on Yonge Street right now.
Ah, okay. So David Foster Wallace, which is interesting, what comes to mind is why he committed suicide, if he did,
he
put out this amazing book, you know, huge book. So he went up Pynchon and Gravity's Rainbow.
Mm.
Yeah, that's outside your door there, eh? The siren?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the, you know, big books like Gravity's Rainbow and whatever else came after in the 80s, occasionally a guy shows up, writes a big book. But you do it in the late 90s when Foster Wallace did it. Who gives a fuck? Nobody's going to read the goddamn thing. And it's an amazing work, but there's no time for anybody to read it.
The best you can get is a career, is work for the next 20 years.
Yeah, as a journalist.
Yeah.
And he probably really wanted to be a great writer, and he couldn't take the fact that it's no way you're going to be a great writer. Your talents are obsolete. It's never going to happen.
Yeah.
You know,
and he's very much someone who is very self-consciously concerned with questions of... being funny in the face of being obsolete and consciously rescuing that from being a merely cynical thing. Like he was really influenced by the movie Blue Velvet because he found, similarly to Once on the Radio, I remember you were talking about, or a caller was talking about how the bird at the end of Blue Velvet was so fake. So very clearly a fake little robot bird, and they're having this exaggerated sweetness and light experience over it that David Foster Wallace wrote about having an epiphany about how that scene managed to like heal the postmodern irony syndrome by being both archly making fun of itself, but also underneath that genuine.
Yeah, yeah. So why did we go off on Foster Wallace? What were we talking? We're talking about the dream, but then. Why did you go into it? Oh, because of the Lynch and... Oh, yeah, the David Bowie.
Lynch.
The David Bowie thing, yeah. And then we spiraled off into Wallace. So the... back to... the David Bowie. The guy says, are you familiar with him? What does the Landis say when he's under the blanket?
So let me ask you, is David Bowie familiar?
It's almost like saying, is David Bowie familiar? You're going to see him. You're going to see a person, and it's David Bowie. Are you people still aware of David Bowie? It's like that, right?
Yeah.
David Bowie familiar?
Or like, or in a way it was maybe seeming more like, well, no, it just seemed very strange, and it made me laugh when I got up, but maybe... If I'm trying to suppose what he would have meant sensibly, it could have meant, is he recognizable?
Yeah, is he recognizable to you people?
Symbolic manifestation or something, yeah.
The what manifestation?
In this symbolic manifestation, in the costume and doing what he's doing.
Now, the costume was a bit of the Man to Fell to Earth, the movie, and Ziggy Stardust, right?
Yeah, it was kind of a glamish thing, but it was also more of an alien thing.
Right, which is perfect Dobbsian stuff. I mean, you got the Exus alien, you've got the media glamour, the icons of rock and that, and he's a combination of that, and then he levitates, And he goes,
could also have been influenced by Marilyn Manson on that one, because that's also an exact description of his second album that I mentioned last night. It was called Mechanical Animals, which is a phrase that appears both in the Revelation X and in Wind and Blue.
Right.
And he had two different image manifestations. He had two different kind of characters in his videos and in the album art, and one of them was an androgynous alien, and one of them was this just all too shallow glam rock band frontman.
Okay. There was something I was going to say there.
Coming up with great puns.
Manson does?
Oh, yeah. Just repeating them with a good appreciation of them, like a new model.
Does he repeat them in his songs? Is that what you're saying? He does puns in his songs?
Yeah, like when he's going to repeat a phrase for his chorus, it's usually something you could actually kind of meditate on, like the different meanings of new model, like a supermodel or just the new model of some truck.
Okay.
Give us a new model.
And he does visual punning.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a visual pun of Bowie, as a collage of his career, his music self and his movie self. You know, the two things, he's putting the two media together, and he's flying up. Now, what struck me about the green egg is that us?
Yeah, never mind that voice in the background.
Okay. The green egg, it was around 2000, maybe 99, 2000, 2001. Every time I went to the Tower record store, had lots of magazines downtown in the East Village, always was the Green Egg magazine, which was put out by Pagans or Neo-Pagans or, you know, something like that. And the Green Egg has some major occult meaning, I think, in paganism or mythology. So,
I've never heard of it.
Right, and Green Egg magazine, so was in my consciousness in 2000, 2001.
Oh my God, okay, well then I just realized, not like I said, I've never heard of it, but then my brain told myself, except for green eggs and ham, and then that's exactly what it is, like hamming up the self-conscious, something is going wrong, but it's actually just self-deprecating humor.
Right, okay, so that would be, if you want to relate to 911, that's the fact that 911 was set up to create fear, yet it was a fake setup to create the fear. So there was some sham level in there. So I hadn't thought of it, but yeah, you probably these nightmares. It's not about New York City as a lifestyle or the city itself. You probably were picking up on 911, and then your understanding of 911 would come through my radio rants and radio talk and all that.
Or my initial shadow understanding of 9/11 came through Michael Ruppert, and it was going to see him that led me to your stuff.
Yeah. So as the decade would unfold, 2001, 2002, 2003, 9/11 would be the ghost haunting it, and you were picking up on that coming and picking up on the antidote or the anti-environment or the Howard Cosell of the early part of this decade. Me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like I review them, the dreams that I had at New York City as a package, and they seem to be exactly that. Because one of the other, the horrible dreams I had, there's the guy pointing the gun at his own head, threatening me, and then there was another dream where all over the city people were jumping off of rooftops, but hanging themselves off of the sides of buildings as if they had nooses around their neck that were anchored to the roofs, and they're jumping over the edge and hanging themselves, like, against the side of the building.
That was one of the dreams. And that's
like a rain of people all over the place, all lit in red. It was quite disturbing.
Yeah, and that is what happened on that day. People jumping out. But you saw people, like this famous picture of the guy and the woman holding hands before they jump. It's like...
Never seen it, and I'm sure you're right about it. Yeah, like you've seen it, but personally, I have never, ever seen this people jumping out of the World Trade Center thing. I was on an island in B.C. when it happened, and I still am pretty conscious about my consumption of the media reflections of that event. I haven't seen any of this Jumpers stuff.
What island were you on in British Columbia?
Cortez.
Okay, because we called...
Came from the west, fuck up this continent, too. Or the east, that is.
What'd you say?
Nothing, just Cortez came in from the east and, kind of bombed everything.
Oh, yeah, okay. It's just, you mentioned British Columbia. I'm here in Maui because of operation we call Banook 2 that was in British on Vancouver Island, which came from Dartmouth, Banook 1, and we call this Maui thing Banook 3, and the future will be Banook 4. But the so this British Columbia resonance is very strong for this decade in me, so that it happened to you. You were there at this time. You were in the Banook 3 zone, Bob zone, when the nightmare happened. So it's just the idea of people, your image is interesting, people hanging off the building. They hung there for a while. And they had to stand there, and they had to decide whether they're going to jump or not. You know, your metaphor of them like dangling with red rope around them. Did you say?
Not red rope. Just everything was lit in red somehow, as if I don't know. It was overcast, and as if there were giant red floodlights all over the city. Because the dream was I was climbing up onto a rooftop to get a view of the city. And it was all over the place. It wasn't localized to a given building. It's just I could see this happening. You know, there was like there was someone I could see jumping about once every second or two in some place in my field of vision.
They were jumping, but some of them were dangling.
All of them were hanging themselves. None of them were falling to the ground.
Oh, they were hanging themselves. Right, right. So
that's what was happening today in the world of financial markets, eh?
Yeah. No, that's right. So here's the thing I see is that, let's say you have a little bit of psychic ability and you picked up a 911, but because you're the glitch generation and have to go through multimedia, a simple prophetic thing that Gene Dixon could have predicted 50 years ago, or any famous Edgar Cayce, famous psychic, just light of facts, you have to go through my chart, 50 years of media distortion overlaid with cultural references just to see the 911 premonition, and it has all this other media stuff, like, you know, your TV body, your chip body, your psychic body, and your chemical body, all mixed up in because you're a product of a later... mutation of evolution of the 20th century. That's what I'm thinking. You actually intuited 911, but it's complexified through... That's just a chemical body disaster, so to speak. But you also were working out TV body issues and chip body issues in the dream.
Absolutely.
Or in the sequence, the several dreams.
Over the course of the dreams, yeah.
Yeah, of the dreams that week. Okay, so that's the dream, and... Makes perfect sense. I totally understand. I agree with you. It's about me and about what I did and how you would encounter me a year or so later. And you knew of the Church of Genius, but that's beautiful. What is this thing that is not quite J.R. Bob Dobbs, but similar? What's the question?
The name that the voice said was the precise equivalent of what I was seeing, in the sense of it was... almost a Dobbs head, but just not quite. And what he said was all I can't remember exactly what he said. What I remember is that it was almost J.R. Bob Dobbs, but not quite. What he said was, "Who is?" And then whatever swerve of the name was actually.
Oh, he didn't
because
say
it was a dream. What I heard was something almost J.R. Bob Dobbs. I'm sure I didn't hear, so I couldn't, you know, find it. What was it exactly? And write it down, the slight swerve.
Right. It was, if you could go to the Akashic Records of your dreams, and you could replay that moment in your life and see what your mind heard, it probably was, "Who is Bob Dean?" Something like that, you know what I mean? Or Bob Marshall never Dobbs Dean. You know, it's probably a distortion of those things, but
it would be the pre-effect of that. But more like what I'm saying is more, if I did go back and replay it somehow, I would come away with the same impression. Like, I'm sure that as a dream, it wasn't as if it was something exact that I just can't remember clearly. What it was minimally different from J.R. Bob Dobbs.
Oh,
as what I saw was minimally different from the Dobbs head.
Yeah, it was like K.S. Tom Lobs. You know,
like,
it'd
be more like J.R. Blob God, or something, like something really close.
Okay, all right. So, and that's blurred, and that's all that he's saying. That's all he says. Okay.
I woke up.
Okay, so that should wrap up the synchrony with the Church's Up Genius and all that. Let's go on to something else, like Terence McKenna, which I've heard a bit of before, but I'd like to hear you develop that.
Well, I haven't necessarily had a lot of synchronicity with a lot of synchrony with Terence McKenna, but Terence McKenna seems more, and I was speaking about this with Convulsionaire when he was in Toronto, and I wouldn't want to speak for him and say that he totally agrees, but it seemed to, at least it's a very vital illusion, if not the truth or something, that all the synchrony we've experienced, if it proves anything, it can potentially prove Terence McKenna's time wave theory, at least in its general sense, if not in the very specifics of it, because it's interesting the way that McKenna's time wave explicitly enables or creates a theoretical ground for the retrievals that McLuhan talked about. And McKenna liked McLuhan, and he recorded an audio tape about him, but just that he talked about resonance of this fractal wave, which doesn't totally determine everything that happens in history, but what it does determine is the greater possibility limit shield of how much novelty is coming through, and that because it's fractal, there would be some large-scale structures that very closely resemble small-scale structures, especially smaller-scale structures now, because the wave accelerates and concresses in our time, which McKenna said was leading up that it ended in 2012. So that's right now we would be in a time when we would be having furious formal retrievals where a small section of the wave very vividly resonates with a big historical period, which could also be described as this aspect of now retrieves this other historical time. It almost provides a direct ground that you could theorize is what causes the specific retrieval.